Okay. So Andrew Wetzel totally stole my title effect the other in the earlier session, so you already know the answer to this question. So what I'm going to try to do in this talk is discuss ways that we can use synthetic surveys of simulations of various types to dig deeper into Gaia data than I think we could do without them. So the motivation for this, just to remind you, is the fact that we can now achieve cosmological simulations that display the kind of disequilibrium situation that we are seeing with Gaia in the Milky Way. I mean, this is just to point that out because it has, you know, mergers and spiral arms and everything. But there's a long way to go between simulations like this where one particle represents many stars. And that's true no matter whether you're talking about a cosmological zoom or about Eagle or about a tailored simulation that tries to reproduce something like the details of the phase space distribution that Shervin and others have talked about in this meeting. And so there's a long way to go between that and this, which is what Gaia gives us. And I'll point out, too, that there are a couple things that are different here. So one is that when you just take the star particles out of here, and you make comparisons, then you're missing the effect that this beautiful dust extinction has on whatever distribution you're studying. And so that impedes, to some extent, our ability to draw global conclusions about the structure of our galaxy unless we fix it somehow. And I'm not saying that to, like cast doubt on all of the people who have worked very hard to do that in the past. But it's a difficult problem, and it's one that at this meeting we've been talking about a lot. You know, what is the Gaia selection function? And the other is that a theme throughout all of today has been, you know, okay, well, what about the LMC? What about the spiral arms? You know, what about all of these things that deviate from our model assumptions? And how can we know that what the conclusions that we draw are really related to physical things going on and not inadequacies of our models to represent the Milky Way itself? And I think that these kinds of simulations and the synthetic surveys we can build from them are the key ingredient in testing that and answering that question, right? And the key in going from this to this is the fact that we need to put in this, which is the idea of a stellar population on top of everything else that goes into one of these things. So I'll talk briefly about how to make a synthetic survey. It kind of applies not only to the stuff that I've been working on lately, but to various stuff that people have done in the past. And then I'll talk about some of the ways that you can use these things. These I'm going to skip over and mostly focus on these last three. So let's talk about how you do this. All right. So there's our goal. It's way over there in the corner. All right, so you have to start with galaxy simulation. This has a bunch of stuff in it where you've thrown in, you know, physics and cosmology of some kind. And what you get out is a thing with one particle representing many stars. And most people nowadays are at the point where they can safely assume that these are representing something that all has the same age and the same chemical abundances. We're sort of at that resolution level in a lot of places now. And so then you have to impose some notion of stellar populations on that. So you choose a set of your favorite isochrone models and you put them on top of this and draw from those. But you also have to spread out the stars that you create by sampling a stellar population around each of these star particles in phase space. And that introduces another set of choices that you have to make. And the groups that do this now at cosmological scales have all made different choices in this particular box, right? So that's one thing, especially if you're interested in details of the phase-based structure of the galaxy, like what we see with Gaia, is something you really have to pay attention to. And what choice is best depends a lot on what science question you're after. And so if you do these two things, then you can turn your star particles into synthetic stars. So now for every dot in this density distribution, you have like an age and magnitudes and everything, right? But we're still not done because you haven't observed this mock catalog yet, right? And to do that, you need to describe your survey. So you need to know the magnitude and color limits. You need some prescription for how you want dust to extinct and redden it, and anything else that you might refer to as a selection function. You need a model for your ability to observe the properties of the stars and so forth. So if you describe Gaia at some level of detail, then you end up with this when you apply it to the simulations that Andrew told you about this morning. And so now you have one particle in your simulated survey equal to one observed star. Right? So this is mostly just to give you an idea of the fact that there are a lot of steps here, and I didn't even talk about all the stuff that went into this part. So I think it's important to be conscious of these things when you're then trying to like understand which is the best synthetic survey to compare with data. All right. So there are a lot of these things over the years. You can, you know, mock up the cosmology by sampling from a mass function and orbit function. You can, before we had the current generation of cosmological hydrodynamic simulations, people did this with dark matter only simulations retagged. There's also been a suite of tailored models specifically meant to represent the Milky Way, which I'll get back to shortly, that stop at a point where you're not sampling a simulation, but rather a set of distribution functions, and in some cases combining with some ideas about the accretion of the stellar halo. And then lately, what we found, what we can do now is to take these cosmological simulations and do this process. And so each of these has some different advantages and disadvantages in terms of the degree of flexibility, the degree to which it resembles the Milky Way, and so forth, and the degree to which it includes the kinds of out of equilibrium components of the galaxy that we're starting to see are playing an important role in understanding what Gaia is telling us about the Milky Way. All right, so I would be remiss if I didn't make an ad for our particular mock survey, which is available here, and you can see my collaborators on this here. One thing that I'll note is that the simulation that Andrew Wetzel described this morning that has the bimodal alpha and FE tracks is one of the three simulations for which we generated mock catalogs, and we included the chemical abundances, although not with error models, so you have to roll your own on that one, as part of the mock survey. So if you're curious about digging into that, that data is among what's available publicly at Z equals zero with Gaia, with a mock synthetic survey based on Gaia. But then the other two simulations are ones that don't exhibit the same type of bimodality if you'd like a counterfactual. All right. So synthetic surveys have always been used to make forecasts and plan strategies for large surveys, and I think that will continue in the future. And I wanted to just make the point that this has been part of Gaia's planning for years. They've worked with this thing called the Gaia Model Universe Model Snapshot that was how you arrived at predictions for how many stars Gaia would see, what they would look like. And if you work in some fields, this is good. It's a multi-component model, more or less in a set of equilibrium functions. It's very tailored to the Milky Way, but there's no sort of sense of cosmological accretion going on here. The halo in this model is entirely smooth. Anyway, there are many, many other examples that I could give there, but I think if we want to talk about digging into the disequilibrium of Gaia data, I will leave those. Another thing that people have often used these four, especially with respect to Gaia, is if you're trying to search for a particular thing in the data set and you have a systematic way to do it, you can evaluate what you see if you apply it to a mock version of the same data. And there were two of these particularly pertaining to Gaia that came out before. So one was using a model for different ultra-faint dwarf galaxies at different distances, luminosities, sizes, and velocity dispersions, and using a systematic way of detecting them in Gaia data to figure out which ones of them you would see if they were out there. And like you can do something similar for dwarf galaxies. This is from Cecilia Mateu's work. And here, the underlying simulation was a cosmological one, which let you also sort of peel back from the observational characteristics of the streams that they were able to find using this technique to look at the masses, the stellar masses, and the accretion times of the progenitors that you're sensitive to, which are the colored points on top of this gray distribution, which is everything. And so this is really where I think the strength of synthetically observing simulations in particular comes in studying the way that you can find things. But what was nice about this paper also was in the observed space, so like ratios of the number of stars of a particular type, and then the width of the stream on the sky, they were able to come up with a very simple formula for what you expected the technique to detect and what you expected it not to, just based on studying the performance of their technique on mock catalogs. And this required doing this full pipeline that I mentioned earlier. This work was done with the Cooper et al. And Lowing et al. Aquarius models. All right, so beyond that, I think where we can start to really dig into what we can learn from Gaia is in a few different areas. And the first one is something that I decided to start out with in order to get the pun in my title out of the way. So as I think probably most of you have heard me talk about by now, a few years ago we postulated this way of determining what the galactic potential was, see there's the pun, using a combination of six-dimensional information about all the accreted stars that we could see in our surveys. And the idea here is that you see them on the sky, you see them in phase space, and then you make some extremely nonlinear transformation that involves lots of assumptions, and you derive some actions, and you see that everything that was in streams is clustered in these little blobs. All right. And so this only works if you're near a good model for the mass of the galaxy, at least within the regime where you're seeing stars. But what I wanted to point out here was that that going from observing something like this to asking whether this is as clustered as it can be, to asking whether that's the best potential that models the system, has a whole lot of complex steps that are not related in a straightforward way to the observations that you started out with, right? Like the actions are a nonlinear transformation, and so when you have observational uncertainties on these and they spread out this distribution in some weird way, and you don't necessarily know a priori whether the model that you're using for the mass distribution of the galaxy is a good representation and so forth. All right, so there's lots of questions about this. So we found that this sort of works at the zeroth order, right, using star particles rather than stars here. And you can see that this distance distribution is not necessarily what you'd expect to get with Gaia, depending on which tracer you like. But we could find that, you know, we assume a simple model of an NFW halo, and we got something in red, which lines up with the dark matter underneath in black. But then what you can do using synthetic surveys is ask questions that you can't ask using the real data, assuming that you have something that sort of represents the accretion history of our galaxy in some way. You can zoom in, and these little different pink lines are the variance that you get for your best fit when you leave out one stream, which you can sort them all out because you know the whole accretion history of your sample, one stream at a time out of the sample. And so that can tell you about whether the particular selection of data that you might get out of your actual observations or the particular accretion history of the galaxy, what that's going to do to your ability to determine the potential, right? So the other thing that you can ask is, so this technique is particularly sensitive to the mass at sort of the mean distance to the stars that you end up using in your fit. And that, of course, is a highly dependent on your particular details of your observational survey that you're using to construct the sample. And so that's where the synthetic surveys really come into play when you experiment with different selections on both the phase space coordinates or the phase space uncertainties that you want to use, and the type of star, which also affects how well you can measure those things. And so this, in this paper, what I was doing was essentially just playing with you know, being more or less restrictive on how well I could, I would tolerate the proper motions being measured, and then varying between a tracer that has sort of order 20% distance uncertainties versus our Lyrae that have order 5% distance uncertainties in our assumptions. Don't get too serious about those numbers. This is just to sort of play with what happens when you change just the observational details of your simulation or of your sample, and what happens to your ability to constrain the potential. But you'll notice that the distance distributions, as you mess with the errors, or the errors that you accept, are all kind of different, and the mean distance that you get for each of these samples, which is where you should be best able to constrain the mass, also changes. And so if you look then at the parameters that you get relative to the input ones, you can see that it does matter quite a lot. You're either off by a factor of two if you pick a sample that doesn't have good, like sufficiently good uncertainties, or you're bang on if you get one that lets you go a little further out, that isn't necessarily a lot stricter in terms of the number of stars that you end up with, but gives you a slightly different view of the galaxy. And you'll notice that, like, you can also ask questions about the number of stars relatively in these samples. So we had some assumption based on some stellar population arguments about how many of these you would expect versus how many of these in our mock halo. And then you can see that our Lyrae, they are bang on, even though they're at a much shorter distance on average. But the error bars are larger because you have a smaller number of stars total. So this is the kind of thing that is illuminated a lot once you have the capability to play around with these things in a synthetic survey. And this kind of complex analysis, I would argue it would be very hard to arrive at a lot of these conclusions just trying to reason through without having done this kind of modeling. All right. Part of the effect here, of course, is the fact that your view of action space is different depending on your distance uncertainties, which is pretty clear from this plot. All right. So that was point one. There are a zillion other examples of complex analysis methods that I could have used, but of course I chose to use the one that I did. So the rest of the work in here is like hot off the press, so be gentle. So next I'm going to talk about a project that we started doing actually when TGAS came out, that is driven by this idea of the classical picture that we've been hearing about all day of what should be in the solar neighborhood based on what we think happens in galaxy formation. And so this is work that I started out with Anna, and then I've handed off now to a grad student at Penn, Farnik Nikaktar. And the basic idea, right, I don't have to explain this to this crowd, is that the dynamics and chemistry of stars is linked to their origin. But with Gaia, we can, you know, make these diagrams in real data now completely. And instead of starting with this idea and then looking for stars that are part of these different populations, you could turn this question around and ask, well, what does the data tell us directly about the number of distinct populations in the solar neighborhood? So we did this test using a very dumb model, which is incorrect for the solar neighborhood. We'll get back to why that is. But just by assuming that this distribution of stars in Tumray plus FENH space, which is something that we have access to in the solar neighborhood for a lot of stars now, is just a sum of different Gaussian components. And so each of these components has a relative weight over the whole sample. It has its own mean vector in this three-dimensional space. It has a covariance in that space. And these things are free parameters. And then you maximize this thing with respect to your data. And then you can fiddle with a number of different components here and then ask which model with which number of components describes your data the best. Right? So the thing we used to do that was this Bayes information criterion, and it looks like this. So you maximize this thing, and then it comes in down here in its maximum likelihood with a given number of parameters, which depends first and foremost on the number of components. And so this is in here with a minus sign, so that means that a lower value of this means that your model fits you better, the data. But then you have a penalty for adding more components to the model, because we don't want to just, you know, overfit every little bump and wiggle in the data set. There are different versions of this that slightly differ in terms of how much of a penalty they get, and this one's sort of more strict, because we kind of think that we'd like to keep it simple if we can. So you can vary the number of components, calculate your best fit model, and then calculate this number and see where it stops decreasing. And that sort of tells you how many components in the solar neighborhood your model would prefer. So lower is better. And then we took three of our synthetic surveys. These are from three different galaxy simulations. So one of them has this bimodality, but we didn't include it because we're only looking at the FeonH and not the alphas. That's a backwards way to say that. What I mean is that the degree to which the bimodality plays a role in determining the best fit number of components here is not very high because we're only including information about the metallicities and not about the alphas in our distribution, right? So you can see that over time, I normalized all of these to their maximal value because this scales like the number of stars in the sample, and that's the stellar masses of these things varies over a factor of a few. So the number of stars in each one is a lot different. But you see that for all of them, at about five components, you start to see a decrease in the amount of drop-off that you get as you add another component. And so it sort of plateaus, except for maybe for M12i. But you can also see that they all sort of agree on that, that the factor by which you've improved the model from a two-component sort of is agreed on over all the simulations, which are all sort of different realizations of the same process of galaxy formation writ in different cosmological situations. All right, so why five? All right, so we can look at the components that you pick out this way. And some of them are like instantly recognizable. Like each one of them has a pretty easy to identify halo component that's sort of not rotating with the disk and has all the low metallicity stuff in it. And then there's always one that sort of looks like the thin disk that's all the stuff that's rotating right there with the sun and has all the high metallicity stars in it. And then there's a bunch of other stuff, which I think is the reason that your answer is five and not three, because of course the asymmetric drift is not Gaussian in this space, and so it's trying to make up a non-Gaussian distribution out of a couple of Gaussians to classify most of this intermediate population that in an ordinary situation we would probably call the thick disk. All right, so we can ask in more detail, because these are simulations, we know everything, do these different populations really correspond to what we think about galaxy formation theory? So we can look at where the stars in them formed, and you see that one has basically all of the stars that were accreted in it, and that's the same one that sort of has a large extent in velocity and contains all the low metallicity stuff. But we didn't put this information into the model, we just asked about these three things. Likewise, you can see differences in the alpha over iron and in the age of the stars and the different components, and they're consistent in most cases with the picture that we have. One thing that's also interesting is you can ask sort of how sure the model is about classifying different stars and different components. And so this black thing here, which is the one that looks most like the stellar halo, this is a distribution of the probability that each star is in a given component. And for the black one, you see that it's peaked strongly either at 1 or 0. So that means that like the model is very sure that stars are either part of that component or not. Whereas if you look at some of the components that are in these sort of intermediate populations, like this blue one here, you'll see that a lot of times it's waffling. It's not super positive about one or the other, but it knows when it's not. So this allows you to somewhat interrogate these kind of models and ask, you know, where is the classification really confident, and where do I need to improve the model by maybe relaxing some of the assumptions that we made to start with. All right. So just to tease you, this is some results from looking at applying this same strategy to rave T-gas cross-match. And we did the same exact thing, and we get that we also prefer five components, which sort of bears out what we were talking about in the previous situations. And a lot of these look similar to the ones that we found with the mocks. And the takeaway here is that none of these mocks are the Milky Way, right? They are not the Milky Way. They don't have the same formation history. They don't have the same structure. But we can still learn by analogy from applying this sort of data-driven model to the mock galaxies via the synthetic surveys in order to interpret what we find when we apply the same type of modeling strategy to the Milky Way. All right, last thing. So one of the things you may have noticed there was that the easiest thing to do with this simple model was to pick out the accreted component. And so one of the projects that I've been involved with more recently is to try to do that better, but not using the kind of overly complete sample that you get in the solar neighborhood with Gaia, where you have six-dimensional phase space information and you get elemental abundances and all this other stuff, but just where you have the 5D information that we get for most of the Gaia sample. And so this is a project that's being led by Brian Ostieck, who's a postdoc at Oregon, he's moving to Harvard, and by Lena Nassib, who's here and probably can answer more questions than I can about this. And this project was an attempt to train a machine learning model to tell the difference between accreted stars and not accreted stars using the mock galaxies, and then see whether we could use the same model to then classify stars in Gaia. So there are a lot of steps in between, and I'll go over briefly what we tried to do, but the point is that this kind of, like you saw with the last example, the stars have different distributions in lots of different dimensions, but these two that I've shown here, which are the V-phi and FeOnH distributions for the accreted and not accreted stars, are not things that Gaia measures for every star. And so you'd like to avoid going into this space and rather just classify on the things that it has that it measures for every star in its range. The other thing I'll note here is the big contrast between the numbers of stars in these different components, right? Like, this is a log plot, and this is two orders of magnitude higher than this. So this problem is difficult partially because of the large difference in the number of stars that you expect to be in each of the components. All right, so an instant introduction to neural network models. I am not going to give you details about this because probably nobody cares. If you want to know the structure, this is what it looks like. Basically, you have a bunch of matrix operations that take the inputs, which are 5D kinematics from Gaia, and then spit out a classification probability for each star, which is probability this one if they think it's accreted, and zero if they think it's in situ, and somewhere in the middle for everything else. And then you have to select a cutoff probability with which you decide that everything with a probability higher than that is going to be accreted. And so in order to do the way they calibrated this for this work was to make sure that the resulting distribution of accreted stars had a consistent phase-based distribution, velocity distribution, with what we knew were accreted stars from the model. So if you slide this guy over, you see that you get to about 0.75 or something, and what it classifies as accreted starts to look in velocity space a lot like this. If you go too far, you get a purer sample, right? But the velocity distribution starts to get all weird. All right, so you choose, one of the synthetic surveys was used purely to choose a cutoff value that let you recover these velocity distributions. And then the remaining surveys were used to help train the model further at different locations within the same galaxy to help with the place-to-place variation that we expect. But then it's not obvious that if you take that and you apply it to a different galaxy, it's going to make any sense at all. Because if you look at the velocity distribution, so that's these three things, or at iron or abundances or anything else, the velocity distribution, which is the thing that you told it you wanted to recover right in order to pick the cutoff, is way different in this other simulated survey than it was in this one. So this is the one that it was trained on, and this is the one that you want to apply it to. And you can see that these are like for the accreta population especially, the velocity distributions are pretty different. So it's not obvious that just calibrating it using one mock galaxy is actually going to work. But if you do a test where you just retrain part of the neural net, so equivalent to like less than 1% of the total parameters in the model, then you apply it to this other synthetic survey from another galaxy, you do actually get something back where the things it classifies as accreted. It's not perfect, but it's also not imprinting features that it learned about the velocity distribution up here to this galaxy down here, which is a thing that you were hoping it won't do. All right. So you can check again by applying two RAVE DR5 Gaia DR2 data where you have this information. And when you look at the results, you see again that you achieve this huge contrast in the number of stars you see. The structure in velocity space for the accreta component looks quite different from what you see in situ. And just to tantalize you, then you can apply it to all of DR2 with some parallax quality cuts, and you see very different galactic distributions for the in situ and accreta stars, so stay tuned for that. A few takeaways from this, and then I will stop. One is that I think from this example, it has convinced me that we're now making sufficiently realistic mock data to try to train machine learning models using these methods. But we needed a lot of different synthetic surveys in order to do this, right? So we used three viewpoints in two of the three simulations just to get the kind of data diversity that you needed to build this model. And more than that is actually better in the sense that more data diversity will result in better performance. They did some experiments with transferring also learning based on the photometry in Gaia, and this was harder than the kinematics, and I think that's maybe a little bit of a statement about the high quality of Gaia's kinematic data compared to its photometry, but I'm not sure about that, and we're still looking into it. It was important to have good parallaxes for this, which isn't unsurprising to basically anybody. But mostly, I think that doing this kind of classification, because it's driven entirely by the features in the data itself, it doesn't require any sort of cutoffs in any other observed quantities in the Gaia dataset in order to do this. And so it can open up new discovery spaces because you haven't already, you know, made certain selections on your data in the way that we've been used to in the past. But again, in order to figure out whether these kinds of classifications are introducing a different kind of bias into our conclusions, you again need these kind of mock surveys in order to answer that question. All right. So that's all I wanted to say, and I hope that we will be able to tell you about many more exciting things along these lines in the future.
Okay, any questions?
Everybody wants to go to wine.
So I'm wondering the dust, the 3D dust map in the mock data.
Yeah.
So is that realistic that we can rely on to do the selection function for disk, or is just some simulation result?
Okay, so this is another thing that different groups have chosen to do differently. In our mocks that I used for the work that I showed here, we infer where the dust should be from the metals ratio in the gas and then calculate a line of sight integral to get the extinction from the simulation itself. It's not the Milky Way dust map. And we chose that because that seemed like it seemed weird that since we had a different galaxy to put the Milky Way's dust map on it, but you could do that with our mocks if you wanted because we also included all of the information to undo the dust extinction and redo it some other way if you wanted to. Other surveys or other synthetic survey groups like the ones that Jason was involved in have done a different thing where they just applied the Milky Way dust map. Related to that though, one of the other projects that I didn't have time to talk about today is one by Lauren Anderson who's trying to use these mocks to test a way of inferring the 3D dust map from Gaia. And so they're good for that because you have an underlying truth, but it's not the same truth as the Milky Way. And so you can you can have some more, again, sort of diversity in your test cases for a model like that to make sure that you're not just getting out what you put in by only testing on something that's Milky Way-like in great detail. So one of the other, for personal reasons, that we ended up doing what we did with these mocks was that I thought this was an area where Gaia would probably make great strides in a relatively short order, because everybody needs the selection function. And so putting an old selection function on a model of a new data set also seemed like I didn't want to do it. But I think the flip side of that is that if you have already an analysis technique where you know, deredden and de-extinctify everything using the Milky Way dust map, then at like step one, then this is not going to be the right set of synthetic surveys for you. So it depends a little bit on what kind of thing you want to do with, and what kind of science you want to do, which is the right answer.
Cool. Any other questions? Catherine?
So great stuff. The one thing I'm slightly worried about, the last, which I'd like to hear your comment on, the last project, accreted versus in situ, do we have enough confidence with how the in situ component is formed for you to feel confident with doing that, using machine learning to train on and then applying to data?
Do you mean how it's formed in the simulated galaxies?
Exactly.
So, I mean, we know when, like, which stars formed in situ and which ones didn't, because we have a complete merger history of the galaxy.
I'm not worried about the disk. I'm thinking more of in situ that are in the halo.
Oh, that end up in the halo.
Yes, exactly.
I have not looked at what happens to that particular population in this classification. It's a good question. It's maybe a relatively small amount. I don't know, but. We haven't actually looked into what happens to those stars, and it's a good question whether or not they end up classified as one or the other.
Hi, Robin. Lovely talk. This may be a bit of a naive question, but do you need to put a cut on the probability for these two populations, or could you just weight every star by its probability and then keep all the data at all times?
Yeah, you can operate it that way, too. And that was true for both of the last examples that I gave, and I think it's a strength of this kind of approach, is that you don't have to make hard cuts in probability space in order to assign stars to a particular component. You could instead just choose to retain all the probabilities and just weight your whole analysis by the probability that a given star is in a given component. I actually prefer to do that, but to do the kinds of tests to see if we could transfer from one to the other, it helps to simplify it by asking about these kinds of cutoffs. Lena, do you want to clarify?
Yeah,
on
so
this?
No, I that's exactly right. And I just wanted to add something, that at the end of this project, we're going to make these catalogs along with their probabilities public. So if anybody wants to play with what we think is accreted versus in situ, then it will be, please have fun.
So I have a follow-up on Catherine's question. So I wonder, do you have a sense of what is actually being picked out? Is it just that, like, the accreted is stars are identified as just outliers in, like, low metallicity or something that's kind of easy to grasp and physically interpret?
So in the last example, the neural network doesn't get any metallicity information at all. It gets only parallax, proper motions, the sky positions. And yet it seems to be able to tell what's what in some way, which feels like witchcraft to me. But I think that information is in there in the sense that there's a clear dependence on, say, metallicity of the stars in the simulated galaxies that are accreted versus in situ. And those are used, and that's not so different from the distribution that we see in the Milky Way, right? And so when you train the model on the simulations, it's learning about which parallaxes, proper motions, et cetera, correspond to the things that it knows are accreted, and by way of that, it's getting some information in there about the different metallicities and stuff. But I think that's partially what's happening also is that the model works a lot better if you use the high quality parallax data. So for all of the stuff that I showed, we used parallax over error of 10 or larger. So it's still not a complete sample of the Gaia data, and expanding it beyond that makes it harder to do a good classification, I think for obvious reasons, because if you know the distance to a star, it's automatically a lot more likely to be in one of these components or the other, just based on that. But that's not the whole story, because clearly also it's learned that it should find halo stars at a whole different distribution of galactic latitudes than than the in-situ ones. And so there's a lot going on there, and I want to press on this some more, because I'm not satisfied with my understanding of it at this point. These things tend to be black boxes, but they're interrogable, so we can do this kind of thing. And I think actually asking about the population that Catherine pointed out is a good way to start understanding this. Like, where do those stars end up?
Do you mind blinking back to the sky plot that you had?
Yeah. Ooh. No.
Sorry. Cool. You just went by quickly. No, I guess. No. Sorry. One thing
is
that
this
I was
the one
thinking
you met?
Of. That it's okay. Cool. No. One thing that came to mind though is when you do the parallax signals to noise cut, you preferentially select a pattern.
Yeah.
In galactic coordinates, because you can only see where the ecliptic poles are, whatever.
Yeah.
So okay, so you've checked that this is not just the selection function.
Oh yeah. So to check this, we actually got the list of accreted stars and crossed them with the subtable of Gaia that had also the radial the 3D velocities, and it actually looked at the velocity distribution, and it's really interesting that we can actually see features that we recognize. So it's the first time I saw that, I was like, that's
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I think
the velocity distribution is a lot more interesting. Cool. Yeah. So it's not 100% the selection function that you're seeing.
So more on the machine learning side. Hello, great.
Hi.
So both transfer learning and uncertainty quantification are a big thing right now in machine learning. So you've considered the first one. What about the second one? Do you think that maybe getting an uncertainty on your probability would basically change that map quite a bit? Maybe, I don't know, like how certain is your neural network about its predictions? And if it's really uncertain, how would that change your results? Have you looked into that?
Yeah, go for it.
We resampled each star, to take into account the errors, we resampled each star 200 times within Gaussian, basically the Gaussian space of its position, of like all the variables that we're studying, and then took only like, took basically, made a distribution of the values and the output, and actually took the top one, so it's, like, yes, and we did transfer learning.
In the covariance, it's already
inside. Oh. The covariances aren't in the mocks. But I don't know whether you sampled from them in the real data.
Yeah, that was actually quite a funny thing because, Brian, who was running the machine learning part, had a sample that didn't have the covariances, and I had one that had, and then we were trying to compare results at the end of the day, and there were like small deviations that kind of took us some time to hunt, and we were like, oh, these are the covariances. So at the end of the day, the covariances will be in there. They're just not in these plots.
Okay, so this is the last question. Catherine has the last question.
So I guess my question was coming from, now I put it more, to try and put it more clearly. I was excited by Kama Gaye's paper, where she looked at two sequences that were in the halo in Metallisti and was associating one with Gaia and Cetylus and one with the kicked up disk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you would find those two different populations as in situ and accreted using this method.
I don't know, but I'm glad that you asked, because one of the things that I would like to do down the line with this approach is to maybe add a few more features where we have features. Listen to me. A few more pieces of information if we have them, like if you have different chemical abundances and so forth. and see if those, for subsamples of Gaia data, and see if we can successfully classify not just accreted versus in situ, but like different components of a particular population. Like take what we decide is accreted, see if the in situ stuff is in there, and see if we'd pull it out by adding information to the model.
See if you can see stuff that's changed its orbit.
Right.
From the
yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we're probably winding down for the day. It's 5:30, so let's thank Robin again. And let's thank all today's speakers again, and we'll see you tomorrow.